Recovering the Seed, How to Live a Wholehearted Life, by Paul Stiles Randack, narrated by the author. Chapter 1. How We Got Here. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of books written about addiction, and how to cure it, change it, recover from it, learn to live with and or control it. Some call it a disease. Others profess that addiction is a collection of irrational beliefs, dysfunctional coping skills, and denial mechanisms. There are other opinions that addiction is an illness of the mind, an addicted beastly mind that runs a person's life amok. Some consider the basis of addiction to be unresolved loss, trauma, or abuse, a primal wounding that results in developing unhealthy schemas to self-medicate pain. In a practical and rational manner, all of these ideas have some truth in them. This book frames addiction not as the core issue, but as a symptom of underlying psychological problems like depression, anxiety, PTSD, or bipolar disorder, mixed in with a little confirmation bias, learned helplessness, maybe some groupthink, and the placebo effect. I also take a stance that addiction is a condition that most humans will experience in some form during their lifetime, because it's a biopsychosocial human trait. This means there are genetic, psychological, social, and environmental factors that align, forming an addictive attachment with something. Addiction is the process of developing a bond with a particular substance, person, thing, or idea that evolves into a pattern or habit, becoming a schema. A schema is a cocktail of life experience and personal stories that form a system of beliefs, conditional emotional responses, and behaviors. This conditioning reinforces the original story, often guaranteeing it will repeat over and over again. When something is repeated many times, it forms a schema. A schema can lead to bonds being formed with drugs, alcohol, sex, work, exercise, or gambling, just to name a few. These bonds can result in isolation and often negative consequences in a person's life. Schemas themselves are neither good or bad. They are neutral. They are the code in the neural network of our mind. It is the individual or the people around you that define what is healthy and what is not. A schema can be something as mundane as driving down the same road to work every day, stopping for your favorite beverage in the morning, while not having to think about performing the same routine or tasks. These routines are carried out with little thought associated to them. I have a client, Lisa, that had not used alcohol in over 2 years, but one day she drove to a local convenience store, got out of her car, walked into the store, and found herself standing in front of the beer cooler. When she realized what she had done, Lisa felt surprised and a little confused, until she remembered that she had repeated an old schema, one she had done hundreds, if not thousands, of times before. The surprise was it had been a few years since that schema had been activated. When a schema is running, things are working at a subconscious level. That group of neurons had formed a network and were triggered that day Lisa drove to the convenience store. This triggering of schemas or neural networks is happening all the time and is an adaptive, learned behavior. We just are not aware that it's occurring, even though schemas are reinforcing the lens we see the world through. Without schemas, driving a car or riding a bike would be difficult. What would it be like to drive, having to think about every time you put your foot on the brake or the gas or turned left or turned right? People seem to gravitate toward those who share the same addiction or obsessions in life, whether it be to a substance, a political or theological belief system, a physical activity, or even a romantic entanglement. beliefs, emotional responses, and behaviors become woven together, creating a narrative about a person's life. Thus, a pattern or cycle is constructed, producing outcomes that bond a person to a substance or behavior, and the personal story about themselves and the world around them. Much of the focus on addiction leads towards the abuse of substances, like cocaine, opiates, and alcohol. But a person can become affixed to beliefs and act out in a manner that directly or indirectly affects their life, as well as the lives of their family and friends. Mark Lewis, in The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease, states that the addiction to ideas, beliefs, and behaviors all share the same characteristics and outcome of a substance addiction. They follow the same course and have similar emotional responses in the formation of feedback loops. It does not matter what issue, idea, behavior, or substance causes it to grow and form neural networks that create a feedback loop. A feedback loop is a reinforcer that produces repetitive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that loop over and over again, forming a habit or an addiction. For 2 decades, I have facilitated family programs in the addiction treatment field. One way I explain addiction to family members is through the use of table salt. I explain by telling a story of someone who goes out to a restaurant and orders their favorite dish. When the order is placed in front of them, they may reach for the salt and shake it onto the food even before they taste it. This is an example of an addictive behavior or feedback loop, as the brain has learned that food should taste a specific way. The chef may have worked hours or even days to perfect their dish, creating a symphony of flavors. A person comes along who has learned to enjoy the food when it contains just the right amount of salt, and that's based on a schema that brought feelings of joy and pleasure from eating food. For a person abusing a mind-altering substance, that search for pleasure may be similar to someone needing salt to enjoy the flavor of a meal. The person using methamphetamines, cocaine, or opiates may have a series of consequences from their drug use that affects many factors in their life, including their health, mental and emotional well-being, their personal relationships, including work or school. An individual who uses salt liberally on food, seeking just the right flavor enhancement, may only affect their personal health and their heart. Although some would argue that their health is more than just a personal issue and may have consequences for their family and loved ones. To understand how people become addicted to belief, forming ideologies, I use the example of theology. This is often a taboo subject, but one that exemplifies the nature of addiction to a belief system. It is especially a touchy subject here in Utah, where life for many is seen through the lens of Mormonism. But any theology, philosophy, or political paradigm would work. The same definition of addiction can be attributed to any who see that there is one true God, one true church or faith. I have witnessed the effects of this when ideological dogma rises above and beyond the realities of personal experience and identity. Belief systems are fascinating, especially theological ones, because much of the beliefs are passed down generationally by what in human development circles is known as foreclosure. Erik Erikson, a developmental psychologist, used this term to describe how children and adolescents foreclose on their parents' ideologies and belief systems for discovering their own truths and beliefs through personal life experience. Religion, like political identity, can be a double-edged sword. When a person believes strongly that their dogma is absolute truth, that belief can disregard or prejudice another person who has a different set of beliefs or ideas. This becomes problematic for adolescents who may find themselves in a personal identity crisis when their experience has not led them to take a position one way or another on the dogma of their parents or their community. When children do not foreclose on the parents' belief systems, theological or otherwise, it can create great conflict within the family system. In addition, part of development for adolescents is to push away from their parents, forming their own identity, often to the chagrin of the parents or family. There is a tendency to want our family systems to remain united, especially those aspects of identity that are entrenched within the family psyche, like religion, politics, career, and moral standards. The more entrenched the family's dogma, the larger a conflict may arise when someone within the family system attempts to differentiate their own personal identity from the family system. The idea that the perfect family system is one where everyone agrees on the values, morals, principles, social norms, and religious dogma is irrational thinking and highly unrealistic. It also may represent an addiction to an ideal that cannot exist. Addiction to a belief manifests when one person disregards the beliefs of another person, whose beliefs do not coincide with theirs. Addiction to beliefs is correlated to a story of being right. In recovery circles, there is an expression that is often used. It says, "You can be right or you can be sober." If a parent is right in their beliefs and their adolescent child is wrong because they have not foreclosed on the beliefs of the family system, then the child becomes an outsider, a non-believer, a problem. It is no accident that treatment centers are filled with people that feel cast out and shamed by their families and communities for not following the right way. And now add gender identity or sexual orientation to the mix, and the stakes escalate even higher. So high, in fact, that a person may seek ways to medicate the shame and discrimination that comes from their family, friends, and community norms. It is important not to confuse conviction with addiction. Having conviction towards a personal experience or belief systems differs from believing your experience should be the absolute truth for everyone. And those that don't share your view are misinformed, ignorant, or haven't found the truth yet. When I bring this up in family support groups, some can take offense. To propose that a parent or family member may have their own issues to address, or even an addiction to a belief system of being right, can stir things up for a family that find themselves already in a crisis mode. That the family system may be part of the problem may seem outrageous to some. In my experience, addiction does not happen in a vacuum. Families commonly play a role in the process, either by enabling, condemning, or scapegoating the person struggling with substance abuse. Learning to be uncomfortable is synonymous with the recovery process. This includes all parties involved in the system. The seeds of addiction can manifest within a family system through an addiction to a belief system, a behavior, or an ideology. When those seeds take root in a person during their developmental years, and they come to find that the system's ideology does not resonate or ring true for them, they may disconnect from the system, or at least the ideas that that system represents. When a family system becomes addicted to some form of ideology, they bond with that ideology and may detach from the family member or reject them for not sharing the same belief. Healthy family systems can embrace and tolerate differences in theology, political view, racial and ethnic traditions, sexual orientation, and gender identity. They can identify the limitations of dogma and choose connection over ideology. Although looking at the world today through the lens of politics, religion, or nationalism, it may seem like the systems of the world are becoming more polarizing. Here, I find the crux of most addictions. some form of disconnection from a primary system, a community, family, social network, and most importantly, a disconnection from self. Research studies now confirm that addiction and drug abuse stem from a lack of connection, a lack of belonging. When given the opportunity to use drugs or connect to a healthy social support network, more times than not, a person will engage in other activities with other people to play, dance, exercise, have sex, and enjoy nature. Johann Hari, in his book Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, explains how when given choices, people will bond and connect to other wholesome relationships that promote healthy pleasure. The point is that humans want to bond and belong to something. If the world that you inhabit creates the repetitive experience of shame, trauma, isolation, and doubt, you will look for other ways to cope with these issues. You may bond with drugs, work, food, pornography, or checking your email and Facebook a few hundred times a day. If the family and the extended community around you all share the same mindset, differentiating from that system may feel painful. Humans will look for something or someone to connect and bond with. If it's too painful to be in the present system, humans will escape that system, even if it's to their detriment. Often it comes down to what feels the least painful in that moment. Even within the systems meant to help a person treat their drug and alcohol problems, there are alienating ideologies and prejudicial biases. Caste system is something that plagues those who struggle with substance abuse. For most of the last century, people who have wrestled with drug addiction have been labeled as degenerates, lowlifes, junkies, winos, dope fiends, bag bitches, druggies, and burnouts. They are pushed out of the system, often rejected by family, friends, and their communities. They become cut off from the one thing that will help them, connection. Our systems, families, communities, institutions, and governments have demonized drug users and abusers, stigmatizing them as outside the norm, which again perpetuates their isolation. This is observable along racial and socioeconomic lines. Even programs like Alcoholics Anonymous may abandon those that thrive for connection, but have chosen not to drink the Kool-Aid of 12-step ideology. For those who see occasional or moderate drinking as possible, a true AA believer will treat that person as one who is in denial of their problem and cannot see the harsh truth of their disease. In some cases, this may be true, but it's not true for everyone. AA, like other programs that embrace the disease model, expect complete surrender to their program. These systems can perpetuate right and wrong, black and white mentality that exists elsewhere in the substance abuser's life. Again, a person may find they are experiencing the same shame and disconnection cycle that created when they bonded with their drug of choice, their DOC, in the first place. AA and other 12-step programs are not the problem, but for some may perpetuate the original issue when the focus is on the drug or the substance. Focusing on the DOC, the symptom, may exacerbate the original problem that existed before creating a bond to the drugs. One foundation of 12-step model is fellowship, which promotes community and connection, for which the person struggling with drugs and alcohol are often in dire need of. One complaint towards 12-step is the notion it is a religious-based program. This may bear some truth, because 12-step models define the solution for addiction is to develop a relationship and turn over their life to a God or a higher power. for a population that is becoming more skeptical of organized religion, AA and 12-step may alienate more people at times than they attract. There are some accepted tenets in AA promoting that the spiritual connection can be the fellowship and not an omnipresent force. Russell Brand, in his book Recovery, reminds us that there are a vast number of people in the West whose higher power is individualism and materialism. Removing the God identification attracts some agnostics and atheists who are open to accepting a connection to the fellowship as something that promotes personal empowerment and well-being. The deal breaker for many is the idea of being powerless, which is written in the first step of the program. It states, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable." This statement, which initiates accountability and promotes powerlessness from an external substance, also advances this theory. You are in this for life. Once an alcoholic or addict, always an alcoholic or addict. Regardless, 12-step offers community and connection to people who share similar experiences and struggles. AA, like other treatment modalities or programs, has a fairly low success rate, somewhere between 15 to 25%. But when we look at outcomes other than abstinence and length of clean time, there is evidence that an individual quality of life, personal relationships, and work experience are better during and after taking part in a 12-step program or community. This means that people in 12-step programs have found positive life changes can occur. Because of its deeply rooted dogma, 12-step can have some of the similar fallout that people experience from their family systems when they don't embrace or agree with the theological dynamics of that system. If you would like a new look at the 12-step model, read Russell Brand's book, Recovery, referenced above. He has reframed the language to offer a more modern interpretation of this conventional system. The 12-step model has its critics. There are troves of books and programs that distance themselves from the disease nomenclature and promote other methodologies, like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, or dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, and rational emotive behavioral therapy, which is the foundation of the SMART Recovery program. SMART Recovery grew out of a book written by Jack Trimpe called Rational Recovery. Jack didn't believe in the idea of living one day at a time, a mantra within the 12-step model. Trimpe reviled the notion that a relationship with a higher power was required to stay sober, again, a cornerstone within the 12-step model. Jack literally demonizes AA and the 12-step model, which is slightly ironic, because Rational Recovery believers identify the addictive voice within them as a beast, which propagates sick, sinking feelings, cravings, and thoughts of use. Rational Recovery has presented an interesting cognitive behavioral tool called Addiction Voice Recognition Treatment, or AVRT. AVRT focus is to fight against the beast in your mind and defeat it, a slaying of one's dragons, if you will. The notion that there is a beast in your mind is not a new idea. This theme has propagated numerous times in the theological narratives. In Rational Recovery dogma, the addictive voice is the lone cause of addiction, and once you actualize and own the conviction that I will never use again, you have recovered. SMART Recovery advocates the work of Albert Ellis, who is one of the founders of REBT model of therapy. REBT presumes that what drives most destructive or unhealthy behaviors is driven by irrational or distorted belief systems a person has about themselves, other people, or the world around them. If you change your story, you change your narrative. And when you change your narrative, you change your life. Though Alcoholics Anonymous and Rational Recovery are considered by proponents of each camp to be very different, I find they are less contrasting than their defenders think they are, because they both have such rigid views of how to treat addiction. Both seem to advocate mythological relations of sorts, battling a beast in Rational Recovery and connecting to a higher power in the 12-step model. AA presumes finding acceptance and learning to live life on life's terms by taking accountability for one's wrongdoing and making amends when necessary. Rational Recovery promotes that you don't need a group or meetings. AA supports connecting to a fellowship to support and sustain sobriety. While all of these ideas have principles in them that foster change, they do take different perspectives. There are people who like aspects of Rational Recovery, but want to connect to a sober community, a sober support system. And this is why the Smart Recovery Camp was one time part of Rational Recovery, but eventually separated from it. In simple terms, Smart Recovery wanted to promote connection, the power of the group process, and building networks through support communities. Mr. Trimpe's Rational Recovery program does not share that same belief, promoting a more individual and self-sustainable approach towards abstinence. Today, more and more Smart Recovery meetings are starting up all over the world. It is showing us that healthy connection is the common theme that leads to a sober heart and a sober mind. Another popular program and a book is Refuge Recovery, developed by Noah Levine, a Buddhist teacher and author who has written about his journey with drugs, imprisonment, and mental illness. This program is growing at a rapid pace around the world. Refuge Recovery is an alternative from the 12-step and the Rational or Smart Recovery model, attracting those looking for a compassionate, service-based recovery program and community that promotes Buddhist meditation, self-awareness, empathy, and sobriety, while learning to move away from suffering and addiction. The Refuge Recovery community advances the teachings of Siddhartha, who is also known as the Buddha, a radical psychologist and spiritual revolutionary who saw the root cause of suffering as uncontrollable thirst and cravings, which is also what some of my colleagues believe is the neurological basis of addiction. Refuge Recovery supports connection, community, and fellowship as a basis for recovery, while eliminating the cravings, suffering, and desires that perpetuate the addictive mind. This program embraces an abstinent-based model, which is the basis of most Buddhist practices. Moderation is not part of these practices, like 12-step and Rational or Smart Recovery. Any drug use is considered taboo and resets a person's sobriety clock. This idea of sobriety equating abstinence is practical and important for many, but does not work for everyone. Refuge Recovery supports the concept of the beginner's mind, embracing the perspective that a beginner's mind is open to many possibilities, while the expert mind does not see any. At the rate Refuge Recovery is growing, it looks to become an important factor in recovery and in the treatment communities. What is most interesting is the diverse group of people that engage in the Refuge Recovery meetings, especially those who have followed another theology. Mormons, agnostics, atheists, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Christians from various faiths all seem to congregate to support this tolerant and diverse community. Refuge Recovery does not seem to distinguish as much between the different types of addictions, whether they be drugs, alcohol, sex, food, dogma, gambling, and shopping. All are welcome. In my experience, it does not matter which path you take, as long as you find healthy people and activities to bond with. And do not demonize or find fault in other programs that differ from the one that works for you. In recovery, like in addiction, it's best to find commonality in other systems, rather than promoting the differences, creating division, and perpetuating black and white, right and wrong thinking. I view program or modality differences in the same way I see language differences. Being an effective communicator is correlated with being a good listener. Learning other languages can benefit a person neurologically, intellectually, and socially. Language brings with it culture, traditions, ethnic history that cannot always be understood without having firsthand experience. Likewise, learning to speak other recovery languages is important to creating connections and building diverse communities. One needs to be cautious not to live within the fortress of a single program paradigm. For when one does, there is the possibility that recovery discrimination may occur and sabotage the foundational aspects of building a sustainable, holistic community. Recovery discrimination, a form of tribalism, is the act of prejudice, demonizing or portraying another person or program as inferior, while promoting a confirmational bias of negative beliefs and attitudes about a person or program, regardless of whether those programs have helped others build a life of acceptance, accountability, and sobriety. I have heard from people who have created a sober, honest, and integrated life, one that embraces humanity, be criticized for the path or program they chose. Holding on to a belief that your recovery program is better than all the others is as much an addiction as anything else. There has long been a general notion in recovery circles that stocking a toolbox with multiple resources is important to exploring a life of sobriety, whether from drugs, alcohol, gambling, food, or even a cult. Building healthy connections to others, living an integrous life, developing tolerance and empathy for others is all part of living a life with a sober mind. Living a sober life requires various materials to construct a strong foundation, and the ability to embrace diversity is paramount. Learning to understand different recovery languages like 12-step, SMART recovery, refuge recovery, and AVRT becomes important to fostering tolerance and accepting others and oneself. Abstaining from all drugs and alcohol is a good plan and has significant advantages, but it does not and will not work for everyone. There is an important acknowledgement that these various recovery modalities do not always embrace. There are people who struggle with abusing substances or end up in treatment that are not addicted, but may have experienced substance abuse or substance dependence due to prolonged stress, anxiety, depressive episodes, or other mental health issues. They may have experienced an event at work, school, or home that caused alarm for their partner, family, or colleagues. I have worked with several people in this population. They use drugs as a coping mechanism, and with therapeutic support, they find and develop a new set of healthy coping skills to address their issues instead of turning to drugs. Many of these people already have strong connections to healthy individuals and their family. We now know that the majority of people who have abused drugs during their life will stop on their own. There have been multiple studies that examined soldiers returning from the Vietnam War that had abused heroin or opium while deployed. The studies have shown that 95% of vets that were abusing or became dependent upon heroin stopped using on their own once they returned home to their friends and families. This shows the importance and strength of connection, healthy, vulnerable human connection, where a person is accepted and understood. The responsibility for connection lays at the feet of humanity, including the drug-addicted person, the family, and society. In Sebastian Junger's book, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, he finds that the need for belonging and connection is universal. People are looking for something to belong to, and finding your tribe is an important part of connecting. Ultimately, people want to connect with something that promotes autonomy, equality, and acceptance. Criminalizing drug use is a path that has proven to be unsuccessful time and time again. It disconnects and even isolates the drug user from societal connection. The war on drugs often becomes the war on the drug user, especially people who experience disenfranchisement due to race, color, creed, gender identity, or sexual orientation. We must come together and define a more holistic model to address the symptomatology of addiction, reminding ourselves that drugs, alcohol, sex, money, food, gambling, pornography, and obsession with social media are just the symptoms of other underlying mental, emotional, and sociological problems. Learning to bond and to connect in healthy relationships and develop a sense of belonging may be the best medication and treatment for addiction. Connection and bonding can extend beyond a partner, family, and community. Connection to nature and the earth may also be an important part of discovering belonging. Without the conscious knowledge that we are part of this planet, that we are cohabitants here, we become isolated from a synergistic property of belonging and inclusion. We don't have to agree with each other on everything, but we must learn to understand and respect the diverse landscape that is before us. Finding the communal experience that bonds us together as the path towards health and healing.